Drama We Go
with Jeremy Scott.
From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, you're darn right it's going to be a hair-raising show, as we're already getting those comments filtering in tonight. Live with you here, it's going to be a show that I've been looking forward to the last couple of months since I started watching the show, Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, which is going to be making its way to the Travel Channel. For those of you who have not, you're going to get an opportunity to check that out. We'll hear more about that. We're going to meet the cast, those who you've come to know if you've seen the first 8 episodes of the show. So we'll have the cast from Alaskan Killer Bigfoot joining us in just a couple of moments, actually. But talking about, you know, a large ape-like creature, something that's very elusive, something that is known across many cultures. It has been given the names of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, even the Yeti and the Skunk Ape or Nantinik. There are other names as well. And while it goes by different names, people are primarily seeing the same thing. Something that could be responsible for the thousands of mysterious missing persons cases, in my opinion. Because there are too many of those to discount. And particularly if you saw what happened up there in Portlock, you know that there's something definitely at play up there. Could it be a creature like Bigfoot? Or as they call Nantinik, which is Bigfoot is known up there in Alaska. It's certainly a new term for me. But the creature is said to have terrorized that village of Portlock to the point that it was deserted about 70 years ago. And only recently have people returned and tried to resettle on the land that their ancestors were sent fleeing from. Or worse, did not make it out of alive. And there are reports of exactly that coming out of the remote village that is featured in Alaskan Killer Bigfoot. We've heard some of those stories throughout the show, and there are many more that were not on the show, but it definitely has a very, very rich history of encounters to the point that people have literally been sent running. It looks like we have Kyle McDowell with us starting out the show this evening. I want to welcome him. He's up first. It's good to have you here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, in 8 episodes, I'm sure that there's a lot that was not on camera. You were only able to show a very short section, I guess, of the overall 40 days. Because it was 40 days in 39 nights or 40 nights and 39 days or something like that?
Yeah, the way it penciled out, it was a good solid 40 days. As you probably recall from episode 6, I believe it is, I had to cut out a little early. But the exact number of nights, I don't remember, because some of the nights felt like they were 5 nights long.
Okay fair enough.
It's a very interesting thing out there with time and how sort of time is, relative to how we normally think about it. And I guess we can maybe expand on that a little bit as we go here, but there's definitely some interesting things about that.
So what are you saying, that it appears that time does slow down?
Well, so for one, like the way I'll kind of explain it is, I spend the majority of the year out in the backcountry of Alaska doing what I do for my main work. And just with that, whenever you go into the backcountry, you just, after a while, you just sort of click into a different groove. It's just time sort of operates on a different construct than what we're normally used to. It's like things kind of slow down a little bit, the clock really doesn't have much of a factor or bearing on things like they do in our normal life. And it's like what we call the natural time or the nature time or the backcountry time. So there's already sort of like that construct. There's like that component to it. But out there in Portlock, it was a completely different deal. It was, it was even beyond that. It was like some days, like felt like they just dragged on forever. And then there were some days or there were periods of time where you felt like it was a very, very, very long period of time. And it was maybe only a matter of minutes or maybe an hour. So, it's hard to explain exactly like what ball or box or whatever to put that in. But I know some of the other, guys out in the crew, in our team also had some of those, you know, similar experiences.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we can speculate on what that was, but maybe talk about what your experiences were. Did you experience the same sickness that others did?
Yeah, I was, I think it was just the second day I was there. I got sick and they showed it pretty well in episode two. We were going out and we were doing a bear patrol and there's some pieces of that didn't translate into the storyline, but we were going out to really investigate noises we had been hearing and they touched on that, but didn't really go into depth on the noises we were hearing. But during that bear walk or that bear patrol that day, it was the real snowy blizzardy day. It was like a complete just crazy blizzard blew in and we had to go do this walk because I was convinced we had a mother bear and some cubs like right nearby our camp. So that was something as, you know, as a bear guard, I really wanted to check out and know, because if we did have a sow with her cubs nearby, that was something I wanted to make, I wanted to be sure of, and I wanted to have an idea of where they were hanging out so we could avoid that area and then also be prepared for those bears to try to enter into our camp. But anyhow, that day during this patrol, just like literally out of the blue, we got into this one zone and all this crazy stuff started happening. We're hearing like these crazy growl sounds. We're hearing all these weird squeaky sounds and like crazy, like thumping, like knocking sounds, like a piece of pipe on a metal post or something. I mean, just like it was all happening at once in a very rapid fashion to where, like, I know for a lot of people it was very overwhelming and it was just like, what the hell is going on right now? And then like right when all that started happening, I just got this overwhelming sensation. Like I was just going to start puking my guts out. And it wasn't like this gradual sort of, oh, I think I'm getting sick. Oh, I think I might puke. It was like, what the heck? Like, I literally feel like I'm going to puke. And I didn't say anything for a while because I was trying to keep, you know, basically keep my composure and not puke my guts out on camera because these dudes are following me around. And I'm like, man, I really don't want to puke on camera right now, but I'm kind of also like, what in the hell's going on right now? And it literally just hit me like a ton of bricks just out of nowhere. And interestingly enough, though, you know, again, this particular piece wasn't really brought into the scene that particular day, but that time I got sick, it was actually right by the obelisk, but we didn't know the obelisk was there that day. Everything was so snowy and it was so blizzardy and things got so nuts. And like the forest, it felt like the forest was trying to like, it was closing in on us and trying to trap us in there. It was like this kind of bizarre sort of phenomenon that was happening. But it turns out where I got sick was literally like a few like steps away from the obelisk, which is also where, Polly, the psychic medium, got sick, and it's also where Guy got sick.
Uh-huh.
And it's also where a few of the crew members started feeling ill as well. So, and, the first, I believe it was the very first day in like episode one, even when Ash got sick, you know, at that point, we of course had no idea where the obelisk was, but he really wasn't even that far away from that thing either. So, connect those dots, I guess.
And the psychic who came in experienced the same as well. And there was also the sensitive who just got that same squeamish feeling, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Yeah. And actually, yeah, you're right. I forgot about that too, because I wasn't there during that, but where they started doing their hike up the hill and she was starting to have those feelings and feel like she was squeamish was actually right by the obelisk as well. But you can see it in the episode with Polly, the medium, and even with Guy, like we're literally right next to the obelisk when all that was happening.
Kyle, did you get the feeling out there, however long you were out there, that you were being watched?
Yeah, I did it. And that, you know, and for me, that just made me want to explore and investigate, you know, the woods. But you definitely always had this feeling like somebody was watching you, like in a very powerful type of way. And I felt that right out of the gate. Like as soon as we got there, I did my immediate patrol to just go try to find signs and tracks. And for me as a bear guard and what I do in the wildlife world and the backcountry, I wanted to just establish sort of a baseline of what's out there and what's going on. And I could not shake this feeling that like somebody was behind me, watching me. And there were other times where, and I don't know that I ever really explained or mentioned this to anybody other than maybe like one of our fireside chats, but I don't believe it made it into the show. There were times where like, I swear to God, somebody was standing behind me and like, I felt like I was about to get tapped on the shoulder. And I think like most of us know what that feels like when somebody walks up behind you, you kind of sense, okay, there's a presence of somebody behind you. Mm-hmm. I had that happen and I'm like convinced it's like one of the camera crew or somebody's coming up to tell me something. And I turn around and there's literally nothing there, at least that I could see.
So in your experience in the outdoors, had you had any experience with trail cams before? And did you find it odd in the experience with the show here that the trail cam seemed to die?
So yes, I've had lots of experience with trail cams. I use them regularly in my line of work. And I've never had trail cams die like that before. And I've never had them show just really weird, you know, basically like we were getting this phenomenon called chromatic aberrations, in a lot of the different camera equipment. And we were seeing some of that even into the trail cams. But lots of weird stuff happening, but you know, when we start connecting all the dots, like we were having just all sorts of crazy bonker, weird stuff happen with electrical things. And so with the trail cams, the most interesting thing was the one that we had up by our base camp never seemed to have any issues. But the ones that weren't by base camp were closer to like either the spooky tree or the obelisk, those were the ones that were like having major issues. But that's also where all the weird stuff was always happening too.
Very, very interesting. Had you experienced noises like you heard there before, or were those new noises? I'm interested because, you know, I've spent some time outdoors, not nearly as much as you guys. So I like to ask, had you heard anything like that before?
Just the noises in general, you mean, or?
Yeah, I mean, could you identify, I guess the question is, those noises that you heard, or were those ones that you thought were a little strange?
Okay, so yeah, there were definitely noises that at times I could identify, but even though when I could identify a sound, sometimes I couldn't find the source of it. Mm-hmm. And one of those occasions sort of, and I'll try to get back on track here real quick, but one of those occasions were, so baby black bear cubs, they make a very distinctive cry. And it was springtime. It's the time that the bears would have been coming out of their dens. And I was convinced I was hearing a baby bear cub, doing the cry to their mother. And the camera crew heard the same damn sound because I actually caught a snippet of it, and played it for them. And then they heard it that night, but they were hearing it right outside their tent. They were like, dude, I swear to God, this thing was like right outside our tent. And I'm like, that's weird. Cause I was hearing it back in the woods. What at that time we didn't know was in the area of the obelisk. So that was what initiated that bear patrol in the blizzard that one day. Was I was going to go try to find the source of that noise, which again, I was convinced it was a black bear cub. And we were even hearing the sound when we were in the woods, and I'm like, oh yeah, it's right back behind this pile of brush. We're going to just kind of circle down and we're going to flank it and we're going to get a view. And I'm expecting like 100% to walk around this corner of brush and see a black bear with her cubs. And we get around that corner and there was literally nothing. There were no signs. There were no fresh tracks. There were nothing. And then as soon as we discovered that, that's when all the crazy, weird sounds and stuff started happening by the obelisk, which is right when I ended up getting sick. Now, that was something recognizable to me, but I couldn't find the source of it, which is a complete mystery in that sense. And I can expand on that a little bit more later as well. But those noises that we were hearing, like right when I started feeling sick, like were like noises I haven't heard before. And one of them, like the best way I can describe it, and thank God everybody else heard it too, or else, like, you know, you'd probably think everybody would think I was crazy if I was telling them, but it sounded like a demon growl. Like that's like, just, I guess what people might think of when you say a demon growl is kind of like what it sounded like. And then these weird, like banging sounds, like metal, like it sounded like a metal on a concrete post or concrete on a metal post kind of sound. Really weird. And so those were unrecognizable. And then of course the whistling, that we had heard, definitely it was obvious, like, okay, that's a whistle sound, but that didn't sound like a normal whistle I'd ever heard, really totally like a person do, or, even like birds or anything like that. And then the one night when Ron Moore was there and we played those, the Bigfoot, the recorded Sasquatch language that Ron has, we started hearing all sorts of crazy stuff. Like it literally sounded like an old creaky door, like in an old cabin, that classic, like, you know, that wooden door opening, that real crazy creaky sound. Like we were hearing that over and over and over, like this freaking door kept opening and we're like, what the hell, you know? And then that's when like rocks started getting lobbed at us and stuff like that. And then there's something else that happened right after that they didn't show in the show, which I don't know if I can talk about or not. I think I can, but, so yeah, the noises were trippy, man. And like, there's probably like for everything that you saw or heard in the show, there's probably about like for every one thing, there's probably a dozen things that didn't get shown or mentioned.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what do you know about the history for those who are just joining us? And, you know, we kind of rushed in to the topic at the beginning of the program without really getting into some of the history and why you guys were back there in the first place. So since you're here now, why don't you give us your version of the history of the area and what drew you back there?
Yeah, totally. So so the history piece kind of came secondary to me because, you know, I was brought on in a position to help these guys out with potential wildlife. You know, in Alaska, when you're out trying to operate in the field, there's just a lot of potential dangers from wildlife. And so I was brought out in that regard. So I never really had like a lot of time to prepare, figure out, you know, the history of the area. So a lot of what I did is I said, okay, where's the project at? What do you need? And then the way I prepare for those things is I scour maps and I just do a lot of sort of research on wildlife and try to examine and figure out patterns of how animals might move for a particular area, where their food sources might be and things like that. So I did a lot more sort of like geo survey, if you will, right? So I'm looking at the topographical information and rivers and streams and stuff like that. And I got a little bit of history about the place before I went. And it was more like, okay, so these guys are going to try to go in here and settle or see if this old settlement could possibly be resettled. And it's like, okay, well, what's up with that? And it's like, well, it's been abandoned, you know, like 9 to maybe a dozen times over the course of history. And, you know, nobody really knows why, but we think, you know, there's something mysterious going on out there. And it's like, okay, so what's going on? Why are they looking to resettle it? Okay, well, their current village is, you know, getting a little small for their current population. So they want to expand and, you know, move into this Portlock area. And the real main bulk of the Portlock history, I actually didn't really start finding out about that until I got out there. So it was more like, hey, we need you to come out, do some Bear Guard stuff. And it's like, got some little beta on that and then got out there. And then they started dropping all this information on me on talking with the guys, you know, talking with Keith and DJ and everybody, you know, about like what they learned about growing up in their village, you know, the stories and everything they had heard and the things people have seen real life. And then the information coming from Tommy and all the stuff Tommy has experienced. And
hold that thought, just, Kyle McDowell with us from Alaskan Killer Bigfoot. I'm Jeremy Scott. We'll get into that and so much more. Killer Bigfoot tonight on Into the Paranormal. I'm Jeremy Scott. Paranormal News reports, the sun continues to emit strong solar flares. Solar cycle 25 is accelerating faster than expected, with the peak not expected till late 2024 or early 2025. This means continued risk of solar flares. Protect yourself and those you love with EMP Shield, the world's first EMP protection technology for an entire home and vehicle tested to military standards. EMP Shield offers protection from EMP, lightning, and solar flares. Get $50 off at paranormalradio.com/EMP. Nothing's more valuable than saving lives and protecting property. Get $50 off EMP Shield today at paranormalradio.com/EMP. paranormalradio.com/EMP.
Paranormal News. How dangerous it is to contact aliens remains to be seen. If there were civilizations of evil aliens, how many would there be and what would the odds be of an invasion? That's the premise of a mathematical study by Alberto Caballero, a doctoral student at the University of Vigo in Spain. At a time when Russia continues to invade Ukraine, he researched how many countries have invaded others over the last 50 years and applied that to the number of known and estimated exoplanets, along with potentially habitable exoplanets. His calculations identify 4 in the Milky Way that are potentially habitable by evil aliens, but only 1 planet that is likely capable of interstellar travel. His math therefore puts the probability of our destruction from hostile aliens very low, about the same as Earth being hit by a catastrophic asteroid. Caballero says the study suggests that civilizations capable of destroying Earth would be less interested in actually doing so as they progress technologically. I'm George Henry, Paranormal News.
What's in outside? Something's throwing stuff at the tent.
Shit. Oh. Yeah.
Sounds like they're stalking you, just walking around.
What do you guys want to do?
What can we do?
I'm not going out there.
If we sit in this tent, we're sitting ducks.
The tree knockings?
Shh.
Paranormal. It's part paranormal and part abnormal. There's nothing ordinary about what's on your speakers. Into the Paranormal with Jeremy Scott.
With the cast of Alaskan Killer Bigfoot tonight, along with Kyle McDowell, we're now joined by Keith Seville. who is one of the descendants of Portlock. And Keith, it's good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jeremy. Like I said, it's a pleasure and honor. I'm not very tech savvy. I was just, you know, going at it with Kyle, trying to get on the site. I'm sure you saw a couple of my messages come across. We got really bad connection down this way. The internet's so slow.
Uh-oh.
But no, just glad to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Glad to have you here. From what you've heard of the program so far, what would you like to add to maybe any of the things that Kyle has talked about to kind of you know, throw a cherry on the top, so to speak?
You know, Kyle is pretty spot on with pretty much what he's talking about. You know, going into even for me as a local, knowing the history that we found out after the fact. I mean, we knew the basic history. I mean, this and that. A lot of the older artifacts and findings were new to me. I mean, you know, we got a basis of the history of Portlock, you know, all the scary, eerie stories, but a lot of the new history that was brought by, you know, the archaeologist Jeff really opened up a lot of eyes. And, you know, like I said, Kyle was in the same situation. I was there in Portlock when I was in high school one time. You know, so stepping into a new territory, what to expect, what's going to happen. We were both in the same boat. We were hearing the same stuff and questioning, why are we even here? I mean, what are we doing? But the story remains, you know, the village is getting bigger and our people need a place to outlet too. So
yeah. You've got a population problem, and you're looking for land that you and your family can basically live on. For those who haven't seen the show, find that it had the conditions that maybe you could survive on.
Well, that was the test, you know, to send a crew down there and make sure it was rehabitable, you know, to bring family back because of getting chased out of there. You know, just like any other big family, family just gets bigger. You know, us looking, you know, for room to expand for the future generation, that is our land, our people's land. Why not? You know, why couldn't it be another option for us to spread back to, you know, the natural setting?
So does that mean you're headed back?
I would love to. You know, there was a lot of stuff that wasn't, you know, Kyle, we talked about it before Kyle had to take off for his, you know, family emergency, and Kyle was into it too. He wanted so much more to do, so much more things. It's just, when we got there, we got hammered hard. The first week it was, we were getting 70 mile an hour gusts, wind, rain, snow going straight across the campus, base camp. And it was ugly, man. We were just having problems one after the other. It was an ugly start. But once we started, you know, building up the courage and, you know, to move into, you know, looking around and the weather was kind of cooperating with us, we were able to find more facts about the area. But like I said, me and Kyle had more ideas about what and, you know, where we could have gone to, as well as DJ Guy and, you know, Ash. You know, we all just had more ideas of where we could have went. We're just trying to find the basic, you know, foundations, the water, food, you know, the basic to set up a community, safety, stuff like that, you know.
You know, I was talking with my wife today. She lived for a time in Alaska near Anchorage, and we were talking about, you know, how remote it can be out there at times, and it really got me thinking about how, I guess, remote it is and how far you are away from things you might need. Particularly, we saw you, I think, using a satellite phone in which to, you know, contact the elder Tommy.
Yeah.
Is that an ideal situation to be so far away from what you need or from help that, you know, you might need?
You know, the area that we were in, you know, our hometown now, no. I mean, it's on the outskirts of help. Like if, you know, if we ran into a serious problem or injury to get medical out there, I think Kyle can agree with me and all the guys can agree with me. It would take a satellite call and just prayers and hoping that, you know, the medevac or whoever is en route is close enough to, you know, get quick attention to the problem at hand. That area is so isolated and secluded by surrounding mountains. There's only one way in. It's either up over the top of them or through Hell's Gate. I mean, going in there on the, you know, the barge to get in there, there's one way in and one way out. So,
I mean, besides the fishing, we really didn't see much about how you guys got your food, I think, unless I totally missed it. Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of what the food supply is out there? I mean, consider me a little bit ignorant on that.
The traditional people here, I mean, we live off the land, the seafood, you know, whatever we can get, big game, this and that, whenever possible. But I mean, we're working basically with the tides for our seafood and food source out there. Kyle got a little taste of what, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of the items that we are picking up and, you know, just looking at and evaluating, okay, this, you know, there's enough here to feed ourselves, obviously. But then you're still working with tides, you know, to harvest that food source. But you're looking, you know, around you on land for what else is there, what's edible, you know. You know, like I said, to get in and out of there was a chore. So you pack light.
Wanted to give folks some perspective.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's that, like I said, that far out, it's, you need to pack light, you know, and be ready, you know, to endure a lot of things. Cause we got hit with a whole bunch of nasty stuff. I mean, whether it was the weather, creepy stuff going on, you know, tent getting destroyed, just the shelter in general, you know, basically out there, you better have your stuff together as a group. If not, a lot of things can happen and go wrong.
Cal, your thoughts to any of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely way out there. You know, you don't just forget something and go run to the store real quick to grab it. So, you know, we took some food out there. We had some basic supplies that, you know, just your regular sort of base ingredients that, you know, a chef like DJ can pretty much whip into anything. And then we, you know, we had intentions to harvest as much as we could from the land and sea, but, for some weird reason, there's really hardly any animals out there. You know, I think from the seafood perspective, you know, the guys got pretty lucky with that, but even, I mean, there's times where even that was really slow and we're all like, we're pretty much all fish. These guys have been fishing their entire life. They do it, you know, for subsistence for their families and village and stuff like that. So fishing to them is like an everyday thing. I love to fish as much as I can too. And I'd say I'm pretty decent at it. And we're going out there, you know, fishing at times and we're just like not even catching anything when we normally would all be like, dude, we should be slamming salmon right now. Or halibut or whatever. And we just weren't. So, yeah.
Kyle, there were some sounds of rifle blasts when you guys were out there.
I didn't mean to jump in there, Kyle. Remember that night we were at the Erie Tree when you told us to back up against it? We heard some sounds, and all of a sudden it sounded like someone was chambering rounds in a rifle.
Yeah.
And you were the only one with a rifle on your shoulder. I mean, it clearly sounded like a high-caliber rifle being, you know, so.
Yeah, so it wasn't like a rifle blast. So it wasn't like a gun being shot. It was the actuation of some, like what would be racking your bolt on a bolt action rifle to chamber a round. That's what the sound we heard. And the more and more I think about all the crazy stuff that happened out there, it's like whatever is out there can like mimic whatever sound they want and then just sort of play it back to us in like the weirdest time and place. That might sound crazy, but
Like, yeah. But I mean, well, that whole area around the obelisk and the Eerie Tree Cabin 1 and just that back, that was like the condensed area where a lot of the everything was happening. I mean, we had batteries draining. I mean, these were brand new batteries right out of the pack. We had malfunctions with the digital cameras and all this, you know, footage and just a lot of weird stuff going on. It's hard to explain. I mean,
one of the strangest moments was what happened with the buoy. I think that was towards the maybe the middle part of the season. I mean, that was clearly an object that had been moved from one location to another.
Yeah,
that was, unexplainable. I mean, no one noticed it was moved from where we put it next to the tent, but 14 feet up in the tree line, you know, a fluorescent item like that is going to, you know, stick out pretty clear. And how it got there was beyond us.
Yeah. And when we first saw it, you know, like my first impression was like, okay, either the crew is messing with us and it's just, we've been out here for a long time and maybe this is a prank and it's like, let's punk these guys. And then my other thought might have been, well, maybe there's some other people out here and, you know, they're messing with us. And the latter, of course, is not good because out in Alaska, you just don't mess with people or their stuff. So that was something that, you know, kind of thinking about, okay, what are we going to do to posture on this? But so we called the crew out on it. We're like, hey, did you guys do this? Like, are you messing with us? And they're like, no, don't you guys remember we've been with you the whole time? And it's like, okay, yeah, you have. I mean, we literally all left camp at the same time. We did this like really big route around. There's not even an opportunity where somebody could have snuck away from the crew to grab that. Because I mean, we're trying to be realistic about it. We're like, okay, what's a realistic, plausible explanation for this? And the first thing is like, okay, somebody out here did it. But it turned out, you know, everybody was with us the whole time. So then the other plausible potential explanation is there's other people out there doing it. That's like where my mind's going. And then it's just like, okay, well, how the heck did they get it way up in that tree? Cause it literally looks like somebody just took the buoy and just like reached their arm out and set it on a tree branch. Cause it was way higher than any of us or a normal, you know, sized person could reach that high.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, after climbing a tree, you could clearly see, you know, twigs snapped, this and that after, you know, investigating up and down, looking at it. It's unexplainable. I mean, you know, there was no markings. There was no footsteps. There was no, you know, it was just odd.
And what about the fires as well? People want to know, well, maybe they set the fires, but from our perspective, you were far away from where those fires took place. I mean, unless you have the ability, like through some telekinesis, or you had some, you know, methods where you lit something and you left the scene and it caught fire later, which I'm not saying you did. Those are just all the possibilities. Right. There must be something else at play, and maybe that would be to send a message that look, if we don't want you here, we're going to try to do everything we can, and that can be even burning down what it's taken you know, a while to basically procure.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think Kyle left before all the fire incidents, the spooky tree, you know, in the cabin itself. I mean, like I said, the guys, we were all sitting around base camp, you know, in the corner of the eye. I think it was DJ saw it first, the corner of his eye, because the way he was facing it, and we all jumped up. It was just like a glow on the side of the hill. So we just went off running, got up there. And it was just like mist. It was like a floating fog. No fire, no flame, no signs of spark on the ground, no nothing. And as for the cabin, I mean, we had the, you know, the family picnic. It was a great day. Everyone, you know, and they were pretty sure that they put it out. I mean, I forget who did the last walk around. I was grabbing all the saws and, you know, whatever I had to grab to get out of there. And backing out, it just ignited.
Do you think that maybe there's some sort of supernatural powers that are at play here from whatever we're dealing with? Whether this is a being, whether it's a physical being that has, you know, the ability to do this stuff, or whether it's something that, you know, is originating maybe in a portal or in some alternate, you know, dimension or whatever, and has the ability to, you know, manipulate objects and to do things like, you know, set fires and, you know, that sort of thing. You think that's possible?
Yeah, I think me and Kyle and DJ and Guy were kind of knocking that around too. I mean, before he took off, he was talking about, you know, investigating certain spots of, you know, Matterhorn when we found the hole, this and that. I mean, what we saw down there, it has to be true. I mean, it has to be. There's no explanation for some of the, I mean, Kyle can, he can elaborate on what we saw, because he saw a big part of what we went through, and you know. How do you make that up? You can't.
Yeah, I think, like, sort of my take on that, and I get asked, like, all the time now that people are seeing the show and stuff, is, you know, hey, you know, do you think like Bigfoot's real or whatever? And I'm like, I don't know if that is real, but I do know there's something out at Portlock. There's something that can mimic sounds. There's something that can make you sick. There's something that can throw big ass rocks. There's something that can turn into a ball of light and then disappear. There's something that can just make all these crazy sounds. I mean, it's just like, what is it? Like, I have no idea, but I can like 100% say, in terms of like my belief or opinion, that there is like something out there. You know, not only do all those things, but also literally walk around you to where we're hearing these, like walk around you, or you're feeling it, but then there's just nothing there. So what is that? Is it some big hairy physical being? Like people think of like maybe this lost ancient ape. I don't think so, personally. What exactly it is, I have no idea, though. I mean,
well, let's hone in on that a little bit, because at the end of towards the end, you brought in this local paranormal group, and one of them was a demonologist. And
yeah,
do you think that maybe there's some demonic something at play here?
Well, you know, like I said, the history, you know, it was a thriving town. I mean, the cannery, the school, the post office. You know, the one thing that stood out in my mind when you're asking these questions was the church. We never found the church. We never found the grave sites. And I'm a big believer, you know, in the Russian Orthodox faith, you know, transition, you know, like I said, how do I say this? You know, can spirits stay on plane or transition? You know, I think Kyle can agree that it can go either way, because there's just, like I said, the stuff that we ran across, like I said, we didn't find the church. I know there was a church there, and we never found the gravesites or evidence to the church. I just know from the stories and the history that there was one, you know, and I kind of believe in all that stuff. I mean, you know, Kyle hit it. You know, there's, how do you explain something like that? That could have been, you know, opening the you know, hornet's nest, so to speak, stomping around the gravesite. We don't know, because we don't know exactly where the church was. That's just something you don't do. You don't go meddling around a gravesite.
Generally, yeah, that's good advice.
Yeah, so I mean, because we didn't know exactly where it was. We were trying to piece it all together on what we saw and bring the pictures to a reality in the show. I mean, obviously the water, we found out where the, you know, the cannery was, obviously the units, some of the standing units that were there. And there was so much more we needed to investigate. Kyle and all the guys are with me on this. We needed to investigate further past the lagoon where they were finding, mutilated bodies. We just ran out of time.
You can't tell us whether or not there's going to be a season 2, can you?
The magic question, right? Everybody wants to know.
I guess stay tuned. Guys, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. A Killer Bigfoot tonight. Those are the guys from Alaskan Killer Bigfoot coming to the Travel Channel. Stick with us.
Want to chat with like-minded thinkers? Join Into the Paranormal Facebook group. It'll blow your mind.
Look around. Supply shortages are everywhere. It was toilet paper and paper products. Now baby formula. Tomorrow, what else will it be? The crisis continues to take on new forms, and it will get worse before it gets better. You need My Patriot Supply. This stuff is the real deal. Prepare for summer now and what's to come by getting essential supplies for survival. With drought, wildfires, record-breaking gas prices, power grid meltdowns, now is the time to take your emergency readiness up a notch and prepare with My Patriot Supply. We're offering you a deal at paranormalradio.com/food. Also, save now on an Alexa Pure Home under-the-counter water filtration system. It keeps 99.9% of contaminants out of your sink. It's not just emergency food that My Patriot Supply offers. They've got products to save you and your family's lives. See what they have to offer at paranormalradio.com/food. paranormalradio.com/food.
Paranormal News. A new radio signal some 600 million light years from Earth is baffling astronomers. The discovery of a bright, compact radio source in a spiral galaxy was made by a team of Australian astronomers who identify the strong radio sources in the Dorado constellation. Its nature is uncertain, although the data suggests the source may be of thermal origin reminiscent of fast radio bursts, however, not as bright. The team led by Joel Balzahn of Western Sydney University in Australia says the most likely origin is a background quasar or radio galaxy. They hope future generations of radio telescopes will help make sense of the anomaly. I'm George Henry, Paranormal News.
It's a huge footprint over here. The heel here.
Yeah.
And the toe.
Is that another one?
Yeah.
Look at that. One, two.
Maybe it's like the right foot and then the left foot.
That's kind of what it looks like to me, yeah. I mean, that looks pretty fresh, too.
Whoa, you guys, check out this print.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you guys have noticed, but the prints look like they go all the way around the pit. And they look super fresh. Whatever made them is really close by.
It's like Bigfoot was watching us while we worked.
I think there's something in that pit that it doesn't want us to find.
I just heard something.
I heard it too.
Guys, let's get out of here.
We'll continue now with historian Jeff Davis joining us, Killer Bigfoot, on Into the Paranormal. We saw him on Alaskan Killer Bigfoot providing some history into the town of Portlock. We've talked to Jeff before about some of the ghostly history around Oregon. He's a historian at heart, and so he was brought in to Portlock to give some insight on the history. Hi, Jeff. Welcome in.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So what did you know about Portlock before you were consulted on Alaskan Killer Bigfoot?
It's kind of interesting. I knew about the European, the United States European history of exploration around Alaska and the West Coast, the West Coast of the Pacific Northwest. But I was not familiar with Portlock. And once I started talking about it, a whole bunch of people who were interested in the paranormal, like you and I, actually gave me kind of looks of, you got to be kidding, you haven't heard of it? Because it is so well documented, so famous in some circles about oddities and let's face it, killings.
And that's the thing that I think I'm most interested here. You say killings because people say, well, these are just encounters that people have with creatures from, you know, yards away. They never really get any close. These creatures never get their hands on people. Hell, we hardly have any evidence to show for it. That's the skeptic's point of view. But you have actually, through historical records, found that there have been reported cases in the Portlock area of a Bigfoot-like creature, something like Bigfoot, that has been responsible for at least more than one death?
Yes, absolutely. The it's funny, as human habitation in the land that is Portlock grew, the number of incidents of not just encounters, as you point out, encounters from a distance, but the more people there were, the more of these really violent encounters that there were, and this actually peaks in the 1940s and 50s. I'm not sure how far back you'd like me to go as far as European exploration, Captain Cook himself, in I believe it was 1778, anchored in the deep channel in what we know as Cook Inlet, and that's kind of the entrance to the Kenai Peninsula. And probably through his spy glasses, he could see where Portlock is. It was the next year that Spanish explorer Bazan, based on his charts, actually landed on the site of what we know as Portlock and performed a possession ceremony by European law, some of which internationally, the international courts still sort of pay attention to. He laid claim to the land and the people within it on behalf of the King of Spain. And it was shortly after he made this possession ceremony that several sailors on his ship actually died. Now, they say they died from scurvy, but it's really kind of coincidental that the day he makes the possession ceremony, they go ashore, that these sailors die. And it was getting worse. More sailors were sick, and so they left. And the next year, Nathaniel Portlock landed on the site of Portlock, and he also performed a possession ceremony. And in the case of Portlock, he actually commented that there were no people there. There were signs of a camp or large camp that had been abandoned. And this is kind of unusual, because oftentimes when European explorers showed up, they had trade goods, but there was physically nobody there. And they sailed several miles in either direction of Portlock. And again, signs of past habitation, but nobody there. Eventually, they met up with, on one of the islands, they met up with a Russian fur trading expedition and were adjacent to them. But then Portlock had to leave. And George Vancouver, the explorer, showed up and he met with more Russian fur traders. But this site, archaeologically and looking at it, the archaeology suggests that Portlock was inhabited intensively and then abandoned 2, 3, 4 times maybe before the historic record. Before the explorers shore up, this is all the archaeology. And so this, we have to rely on the oral traditions of the native people too. And this is where we get to the introduction of Nantinak, is why they were abandoning the place. And into the historic, really later historic times, the United States acquired Alaska from the Russians as property and land and people in the 1860s. And sometime in the late 1800s, a fishing community grew up in Portlock. And in the very early 1900s, they established a full-blown cannery operation there. So you had people at least seasonally there working the cannery. They were anchoring their ships in the little inlet, the little bay. And it's in the later 19, was, can I say mid early 1900s, 20s, 30s, into the 40s, that people are not just in Portlock, of course, on their days off. People are going hunting, and they're going up into the hills. And that is where these encounters seem to begin. And there were several people, hunters, mostly going up into the hills, or off-duty cannery workers. In one case, a miner went up, and some of them disappeared. My memory, I'm thinking over 20 people, and some of the bodies they did actually find. Some of these missing people, days, weeks later, their bodies were actually washed up downstream from the mountains into the lagoon outside of Portlock, and they had been savaged.
From my understanding, the cannery burned down?
Yes, it burned down. I don't remember the exact date. In the late 30s, early 40s, it had burned down, and of course, a lot of people left. A few years later, they rebuilt the cannery even bigger than before. There were, at one point, listed 100 seasonal workers working between the cannery and the fishing fleet. And, of course, they had their families with them. And when the cannery season was over with, of course, there were still people living there full time. And the federal government and the Alaskan state government, or Alaskan territorial government, believed so much in the promise that these communities would grow that they even in the early 1900s established a post office there, which was quite a prestigious government office for a small town.
Keith told us that they didn't find a church. In your historical research, did the town or the village have a church?
Yes, without a map to show you, but culturally, almost certainly, the native peoples in Nanwalak and in Portlock would have mostly been Russian Orthodox Christians, and they're very religious folks, and I cannot see them not having a church. And along with the church, maybe there should have been a churchyard, especially if you had over a dozen people, maybe two dozen people, go missing and die. And I'm really curious about the town site. Maybe if they get to go back and explore on camera, just try and find the layout of the abandoned town.
Exactly. So tell us about your work on this show and for what purposes you were brought in and how that went. Give us kind of some behind the scenes perspective.
Sure. I am actually, for what it's worth, I have a bachelor's in anthropology and a master's in archaeology. And so I was born and raised in Washington State. And so I worked as a field archaeologist for the U.S. Forest Service in the Cascade Mountains for a number of years. So that kind of ties in with why bring me in specifically to talk about native lifestyles. And what's always interested me, and this flows from anthropology, is the stories people tell about themselves, their own worldviews. And this has been proven time and again that I don't say native stories. I shouldn't say native stories, traditions, in that oftentimes when people use the phrase fact check oral traditions, they oftentimes find there's a lot of accuracy in them, sometimes more than just this little small kernel of truth. There's a lot of truth to them. And in my personal library, I have, because I'm interested in traditions and tales of supernatural beings, I have a fair number of anthropological references where the anthropologists did, from the very late 1800s through the early 1900s, talk to native peoples when they were still elders alive, who remembered what it was like before the Europeans arrived, or that transition time. And they shared a lot of stories about supernatural beings. Depending on which kind of language you're using, in the Chinook jargon, which was kind of a trade language that was used along the Columbia River in the Northwest coast, the one word that comes up is skookum. And a skookum is a powerful supernatural being. And they're also tilikum or elliptilikum. And in the kind of the worldview of a lot of native peoples, magical beings are real too. And they have their own traditions and their own way of kind of subdividing this being or creature. Is related to this. They have the following attributes and powers, just like you talk to a cryptozoologist or a standard biologist, where they're looking at classifying these animals. One of the more interesting things is a lot of the native peoples here in the Northwest believe that the Earth went through a variety of changes, where the Earth existed and there were natural beings and animals and people and supernatural beings. And then for whatever reason, a cataclysm, the Earth would actually change. And when that happened, many of the supernatural beings didn't cease to exist. They were changed. They were transformed. In some cases, some of these supernatural beings, which were animate, they could move around, they had bodies, they became standing stones in areas, and where their homes were are now kind of sacred groves or sacred mountains. And so the tradition of Nantinak seems to kind of flow from that. And it's not just Nantinak itself that some of the natives describe. There's a tall woman wearing with dark hair and pale white skin, wearing a black dress that trails behind her. And one of the elders reported that people had seen her, and she would come out of a cliff face in the mountains and come down, and then she would go back and disappear into
so ghosts and mountain. Critters, literally.
Yes. And I, in falling back on skookum, all big feet are skookums, but not all skookums are big feet, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so based on some of what happened to, and this is just me, this is not, I'm not speaking for Ash and Keith and the others. It needs more exploration and more testing. Is it just a simple Bigfoot? Because a lot of what's happened to them and other people in the Portlock area, it's not your traditional cuddly Bigfoot, is it? It's something a lot more malevolent.
Yeah, I mean, something cuddly, like you said, doesn't cause a grown man to scream for their lives, as we saw in multiple cases on that show. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the program and giving us some of the history of Portlock. It's an important story to the tale as told on Alaskan Killer Bigfoot.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And my thanks to Keith and to Kyle as well for joining us in the first hour of tonight's program. Stay tuned to see where and when, well, we know where, Travel Channel, but when Alaskan Killer Bigfoot will be making its debut. Stick around, friends. We'll have that information for you. From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I'm Jeremy Scott. Good night, everyone.